You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
There's a fairly recent technological tool that the University of Oregon has access to called a DEXA scan. Mm-hmm. However, it also precisely measures body fat. I think the University of Oregon track program, and I don't think it's the only program at athletic program at the school that does this. They were asking, at least in the cases of these women, I don't know if it was universal, but these women were asked to maintain or lower a body fat, their body fat percentage. And in some cases, trying to do this led them into dangerous territory as far as eating disorders and potentially injury.
The Meadowlarkers are back. I am joined by Amin Alhassan, Tom Haverstraw, Howard Bryant. I'm Kate Fagan. This story coming out of Oregon track and field, as reported by the Oregonian, is a strong jumping off point to a conversation about our obsession with analytics and metrics, obsession with body, in a lot of ways, coaching and the devaluing of coaching, actually done within this article by this track coach who becomes obsessed with numbers. So there's a lot of places to go jumping off of this Oregonian story. Tom, I'm going to pass you the ball first here. What did this make you think of?
Yeah, well, first of all, Robert Johnson, the UO track coach, is Nick Saban. He's Coach K in basketball. This program, this Oregon track coach, he is as big as any coach in his field, no pun intended. And so this is a humongous story. Think about this program like Alabama, Duke basketball. That's what we're talking about here. And I can't imagine he's standing by the quote in this story. Track is nothing but numbers. A good mathematician probably could be a good track coach. That quote to me is just so damning on a number of levels. One, I wonder if mathematicians get paid as much as Robert Johnson does, if he's a good track coach. And two, this dehumanizing aspect of this story is really alarming to me. Is that, doesn't it feel, Kate, to you that if you treat these human beings like they're numbers, that they are just inputs on a spreadsheet, I think it makes it pretty easy to not think of them as human beings, to not treat them as human beings, to not understand the long-term effects of telling these young women, hey, are you 13% body fat? As if that's like, I don't understand all the sports science here, but I'm pretty sure there is measurement error here involved. Like 13% is not some magical number. 12% is not some magical number that leads to gold medals or shaving 12% off your time. This all just feels like the machinification of athletes, college athletes, who, as they state in this story, aren't getting paid.
Yeah.
This is not the Miami Heat asking you to get your body fat percentages every Monday during training camp. These young women are not being paid and are having to suffer very long-term effects, which if you think of them as just numbers, you might be able to sleep at night.
Yeah. Well, I think we definitely want to get to broadening this conversation out to include the NBA and to include how we look at all bodies in sports. But just to stay for a second on the college aspect of this, like these women at Oregon and the men at Oregon, they're like, some of them are 1 year removed from like making Muddy Buddies and eating Skittles on long car rides to cross country races.
What's a Muddy Buddy?
Thank you for asking, Amin, because a Muddy Buddy is when you take Chex Mix and you mix it with melted peanut butter and chocolate and you roll the Chex Mix, not the Chex Mix, Chex cereal in peanut butter and chocolate. And then you dust it with powdered sugar. And you eat it on the way to a cross-country meet or any weekend event in high school. It's a huge cross-country thing. You can ask any cross-country runner because it's got peanut butter in it. It's got peanut butter. So it's like, this is the kind of thing you eat for a cross-country meet. I didn't know we were going to go there, but there you go. So like these athletes are coming off of a high school career, which I'm sure that this kind of intense science and nutrition is trickling down further and farther and farther right now into our youth sports. But for the most part, they are coming into a program like this and being set standards, Olympic level standards. And there's this obsession, especially in track and field, because it is driven by numbers. There's an obsession that creeps into every part of track and field when it comes to metrics. I was actually talking to Kara Goucher, former Olympian, last week about this kind of stuff. And she was talking about how when she ran her fastest ever marathon time, she was also at her highest weight ever, because these things are not directly correlated. And I think we do want to get into this. Yes, there's weight and numbers play a huge role in sports, but our obsession thinking that this is a one-to-one, that weight equals health equals performance, especially in track and field, but you see it in every sport. It's like these coaches, they're obsessed with control and they're obsessed with a lot of things and they can't control everything. But a lot of times you see them thinking, I can control numbers, I can know the numbers, and I can penalize kids if they're not reaching numbers. And it's, to me, it's this struggle for power and control that coaches have, and you see it pressed down upon a lot of athletes, and in this case, very vulnerable younger athletes at the college level.
The danger is the linear relationship, that this equals that. That's it. So the idea of taking greatness that is objectively great and then breaking that greatness down to their measurements. What was Flojo's body fat percentage, right? Or Michael Johnson, what did he do or whatever? And then using those as standards for this is how you do it. And then holding people to these standards, not because they actually result in greatness, but because you've arbitrarily decided that since greatness had these attributes, ipso facto, that's what it takes to be great. And that's what you see in this story. In there, we have a female athlete's optimal body fat percentage is 14 to 20%. And yet the University of Oregon say you need to get down to 13. Where does that come from? Where are these happening? That quote that Tom threw out there where the athlete said, hey, we're not professional athletes. We don't have access to bounty of organic food. We don't have unlimited time to cook. We cannot plan our days around our nutrition. And here's the kicker. And we are not the 30-year-old Olympians that Coach Johnson seeks to compare our body fat percentage to. It is akin to saying you're not a great shooter because you don't shoot as well as Steph Curry. Wait a second. I know that's the ideal. I know that's what we're working to. But to hold those as standards rather than even goals, and there's a conversation whether goals are even a realistic enough metric, that's all problematic. It's problematic in the sense of, again, the age of these athletes and the conditions under which they are training and becoming better. But it's also problematic because there's no literature that shows if my body fat percentage is the same as Shelly Ann Fraser, right? I can't just copy Shelly Ann Fraser's physical body measurements and characteristics, her blood pressure, you know, her oxygen level, and then say, if I can just hit these metrics, I too will be one of the fastest people on earth.
I mean, I just talked to a track coach, longtime track coach who coaches Olympians, mostly on the female side. And he said he never used a DEXA scan ever as a coach. In fact, would always, if that was a concern of like, hey, we need to run a DEXA scan on this athlete, it was always not the coach. It was the team physicians that handled that information. It was a separate, like, coaches.
Explain to people what a DEXA scan is, because until I read this story, I wasn't aware of it either.
It's a bone density scan. It's an X-ray to see the bone mineral density on your body. And essentially, you can not only look at bone density, but also your body fat percentages. And this coach was just laughing over the phone. Like, the idea that a track coach should have access to this data on all of his athletes on a monthly timetable, that's a standard, that's a requirement, that's a medical issue. That's osteoporosis. That is, like, the only reason why you might need this is to see if you're more prone to a medical issue or an injury. But that's not something that the coach should be handling, that information. That's not coach domain, right? So it is just really overstepping boundaries from what a coach should be handling. And it really comes back to, again, the machinification of these young women that and all college athletes, that they're not being compensated or expected to, I don't know, it just seems like they are being viewed as disposable in this sense, that like they aren't real human beings. They aren't considered people who have life after these couple years at Oregon.
Right. Like there's no room for different strategies, shapes, sizes, personalities. It's no matter what you came in looking like a sculpture, we are chiseling you down into this form that we have decided will map on to our idea of what the fastest time will produce or an Olympian will produce. And it's incredibly frustrating because when you look at even the movie world or the book world, you always see like, well, Harry Potter comes out, then everyone just wants Harry Potter. It's like some popular movie comes out, all we want is Marvel movies. And in the same way, it's like, okay, so we've seen that a female runner with this body fat percentage once won a gold medal. Therefore, we have decided that now every athlete must be shepherded along this assembly line until one comes along, breaks the mold, and then we'll want that mold of what the perfect athlete should be. Now, athletics are a little different because you have more data saying, like, this is good, this is bad, this is what works, this is what doesn't work. But if you're a fantastic coach, you should be able to take all kinds of personalities, different runners, different strides, different shapes, and your goal shouldn't be to, like, try to get them to fit into an Excel cell spreadsheet. Your goal should be able to take their version of who they are and make them the best athlete they can be and not try to fit them into your mold. But of course, we know that's not how sports generally works.
I just sort of feel like this is an extension of where it's all going, right? I mean, you want to talk about dehumanizing. How is this different than the College Board? How is this different from deciding what stolen base percentage you have to in order to steal, and not looking at the actual game and the game situation? It is absolutely dehumanizing, because that's the goal, is to dehumanize, right? Like, what is the phrase that I hate so much in the NFL? Next man up, right? You're not people. When you're watching a baseball game, it's not even about competition when you're pitching anymore. It's about, it's at this assembly line of, let's see if we can get 27 outs. And if the starting pitcher goes an inning and a third, okay, we got 10 other guys. I'm like, that's not why we're watching this. I think when I was reading the story about Robert Johnson, the piece that really struck me was, at no point did he discuss any physical emotional connection to these athletes that have made him a champion. If you're the Mike Krzyzewski of your sport, don't you give the athletes some credit for giving you the life that you've had? I mean, isn't there a human relationship to this, or are they experiments? And it felt very antiseptic to me.
The other thing that I find curious is the idea that it works. We're just kind of taking their word for it, that it works. You know, in the story, we got multiple athletes who are having problems with their menstrual cycles. We have athletes who are dealing with eating disorders, athletes that are dropping out of the program. And my thing is, it's not even, let's say it is dehumanizing, all right? And let's say I'm Robert Johnson, I don't care. They're all numbers. They're all just things that I plug into my spreadsheet. But is this really even successful? Like, are you?
Okay. That's interesting, Amin, because I think that it makes me think of like vulture venture capitalists, whose goal is to go into a corporation and like maximize profit for the shortest amount of time with no eye to the longevity of that company. So they're coming in and they're saying, look, we can just cut the workforce, we can devalue the product, but like in the meantime, profitability is going to go up and we don't care. That's all we care about. We don't care if in 10 years this newspaper has no subscribers and like two reporters because we got our money out. And that's how this feels to me. It's like, does it work?
But even that example, there's some short-term gain, I think, that is in a vulture venture capitalist kind of thing, right? Like, it's not good for the business, but it's good for the company coming in to do it. My thing is, I don't even think it's good for Robert Johnson and for Oregon track and field, because at the end of the day, you could say, well, look at all our national championships. Well, it's not like you took me and Tom off the street. You're taking the elite. Oregon is one of the top, if not the top, track and field outfit in the all the land. Of course,
speak
if I
for
have
yourself, I mean,
of course, if I bring in the best of the best out of the high school class, I could do all types of shit, and they're probably still going to be better than most other programs. So again, like,
well,
I,
let's not forget the overarching entity of this program, Nike.
It's Nike. It's Phil Knight, and running is his thing.
Yep. There is a lot. There is a lot of eyeballs on the Oregon track and field program at the highest levels of Nike, and being able to win on Oregon track and field is as important to Oregon as it is to Alabama football to win. So,
and I'm sure Phil Knight saw that story and says, "What do you mean you don't have access to the best organic food? We'll fix that."
That's right. That was his takeaway.
Because this is a huge power dynamic. I can't speak up because I'm not just saying goodbye to this scholarship or this tuition or what have you, my spot on the team. But like, Robert Johnson is a huge figure in the USA track and field pipeline and mm-hmm. Nike, that you're not just turning your back or alienating Oregon, you're turning back on all your dreams, it might be. And that's a right. huge, that's a right. huge decision to speak up. And in that, Robert Johnson, in the quotes in the story, was saying, "You didn't speak up. How are we supposed to help you? We can't read your mind." And I'm sitting here like, but if you could, I think you would, right? Like, right? Like, we can't read your mind, as if like, oh, we have
let's
a moral.
Let's develop that technology.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, hey, Phil Knight, let's get on that.
Hey, it's Mike, and I know you were hoping for an update on those fishtail ponds in my backyard. Well, have I got news for you. I actually got lighting installed, and I can change it with an app. Beautiful fishtail ponds lit up red, depending on my mood. If my hockey team wins, we light those suckers red. Anyways, I like being outside. I like looking at those fishtail ponds. You love hearing about it. But what's in my hand other than my app changing the lighting? A Miller Lite is in my hand. That's right, because I know when a Miller Lite is in my hand, I make a good time, Miller time. I take that first sip. I know immediately I made the right call. Nothing goes with my fishtail ponds quite like a Miller Lite. It makes everything so much better. And I'm going to have some people over. I'm going to toss them that beautiful white can. They're going to say, heck yeah. And they're going to have that first sip and know, just like me, that they made the right call. Times change, but you can always enjoy the great taste of Miller Lite. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces.
I want to talk a little bit about broadening it out to like the, what I see is oftentimes a flawed correlation to fitness and premier physical achievement being weight, body fat percentages. Not suggesting there's no correlation, but that historically it feels like we have always been obsessed that fat equals flaw equals weakness, and you know, physical fitness in the way we deem it to be, whatever that is, equals, you know, a visual physical fitness equals the highest levels of achievement. So by this, I mean, like, we're looking at this story, we're looking at, you know, the DEXA scan, and this is the latest piece of technology that certain coaches have decided if our athletes fit into this vertical, they have the best case body to achieve the way we want them to achieve. It makes me think about the physical fitness, the presidential physical fitness tests that we all had to take, that we were told was a representation of athleticism, was a representation of physical fitness. These like five things we had to do, right? The shuttle run, the static hang. Like, it seems that we have always had a flawed relationship with thinking the next greatest thing is the thing that best represents physical fitness. And it's always been flawed. It always evolves. And now the current thing, you know, it was like the pinch test for body fat like 15, 20 years ago.
Do they, you know, not
they
do
pinch
that anymore?
Like your upper try. They don't do that anymore. And now we've got this DEXA scan. And it's like we can't just not have to name things and have the latest science. Like, we need to rigorously apply it. Like, unilaterally, we can't actually allow for the fact that, like, well, this is just the latest and it needs to grow and there needs to be room for humanity and we need to be able to communicate with our athletes. It's just like rigorously applied as if it's a one-to-one comparison.
Yeah, and there's that. And there's also the fact that when you have a program as successful as Oregon, how quickly your other school is going to adopt it because they're the standard. And before you know it, you can't transfer because of this, because they're all doing the same thing. Where are you going to transfer to when these things become the model? So there's no question that this is dangerous stuff. And I think that, to me, when I was, you know, the different layers when you're reading the story, and just thinking about the implications of incorporating this type of unilateral, these sort of unilateral standards, it just makes all of what we're watching less enjoyable and certainly less playable, right? I mean, if you're thinking about being an athlete, one, people never talk about the sacrifices that you have to make in terms of your diet and your routine anyway. So how much more debilitating has this become, right? If you're going to be a world-class athlete, there's already a whole bunch of stuff you can't do when it comes to the food for pleasure thing is not part of your game anyway. And there are all kinds of people. I was actually talking to our good friend Bomani Jones about this, about coming on here and having this discussion. And we immediately both sort of navigated toward, just gravitated straight to Larry Allen from the Dallas Cowboys, the old offensive lineman, who did not look like an athlete necessarily at all and is one of the best athletes ever, right? So how do you account for some of those freaks of nature? Why can't you have that sort of diversity of the athletic body? It's, you know, you really can't. Can you tell all of the things that you think you can tell from the technology?
So for me, when you talk about professional athletes, I think there is a distinction there in that the desire for people to be of a certain physical condition also is a lot about preventative measures, right? Obviously, a lot of my time was spent in Phoenix. I was around what many people consider to be the best training staff in the league at that time. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that they preach, people, you say, oh, how do these guys come back good as new? How do these guys, you know, Steve Nash, everyone thought he was done and is back, and he comes back and he has two MVP seasons. And Amari Stoudemire with the microfracture and a torn ACL in the other, and he came back still dunking on people. And Antonio McDyess and Shaquille O'Neal and Grant Hill, just long list how. And a lot of it starts in prevention. It's not even about rehab or fixing. It's fixing things that lead down that road. And that part of that is nutrition. And so for, again, and this is where the tie-in to basketball comes with Zion is the example that we think about. It's not so much, oh, you'd be dunking on more people or you'd average 40 if you drop some pounds. It's more fundamental than that. It's like, you wouldn't be hurt. You or wouldn't be hurt as much. And maybe this isn't, not a one-to-one. You lose weight and you'll never get hurt again. But there is a tie-in to a guy who, since his freshman year at Duke through now, has had an injury to his lower extremities every single season but one. It's connected. There is a thing to it, and it goes beyond just, hey, you need to have a body fat percentage of this according to this scan, and more of just like general tenets of what's your diet look like? What's your cardio program look like? And those things. And I don't think that's too much to ask of someone in that condition. The problem, what we're talking about this Oregon story, is A, they're not pros. So as the athlete pointed out, they don't have the access to the dietary diversity that Zion at least hypothetically has available to him. And then second of all, I'm pretty sure, maybe I'm jumping ahead here, but pretty sure none of those athletes look like Zion. None of them were coming in hefty like that. And that leads to another conversation we talked about in the pre-show, Kate, the idea that what we consider to be overweight for a female athlete versus for a male athlete are two wildly different things.
Yeah, I think that there's something else worth considering here too, and that is we got to look at the umbrella as well, like the framework in where we all live, which is the weight stigma in this country in general, right? That is the very first thing, is that we have a certain relationship with weight. It's not innocuous. And I always say, when you're watching a movie or TV or whatever, what is the first rule of comedy? I always pick on the fat guy, right? It's always like the first rule. Like, I was watching Indiana Jones last week. There's the fat kid with the bugle. And of course, he's the bumbling one who can't get it together. You watch Old School, the guy's morbidly obese, right? And you, this is where Chris Farley and you know, John, this is Belushi. Where we go for laughs. John Belushi, this is where we go for laughs. That's the first thing. And in going there for less, there's also, you know, like Melissa McCarthy and Bridesmaids, right? In going for that laughter, there's also, there's a sloth involved in there too, that you are less dedicated, that you are not as healthy because of what you're bringing, of how you, you know, present, that you're probably not very disciplined when it comes to your eating habits or your work, all of these things. All of these things funnel in. And the one piece that to Amin that I tend to disagree with a tiny bit is that, yeah, I absolutely understand the distinction between being professional and being amateur. But at Oregon's level, they view themselves as pros, I would imagine. I don't think that they look at themselves like, oh, yeah, you know, we're just a small D3 school. We just want you guys. Now, those guys, that's world class. And whatever the designation is, if you're considered world class, it doesn't make a difference if you're Olympic, amateur, or professional.
I would say the when I say pros versus amateurs in that case, I'm talking about the, and I get it, Oregon has world class facilities, and but resources of A, to procure the food that you need, and B, and this is probably most importantly, and this goes across all of collegiate athletics, do I get to spend 24 hours of my day on my craft? Or do I have homework and a midterm and a paper due and a group project and all that other bullshit?
The thing that exists at the NCAA level that is relevant for this story is this thing that I always call like misaligned goals when it comes at the NCAA level. Like at, on the pro level, for the most part, it's a paid job for the coach and it's a paid job for the athlete. And the goal is to get the most out of you and hopefully win if that is what you need to be doing, or lose occasionally. But like all of those goals are generally aligned. At the NCAA level, most student athletes outside of like high-end football and big-time D1's men's basketball, they have more goals than just shaving seconds off of their PR. And runners are incredibly dedicated. But like you come into college, like you also are still thinking the things college kids think. I'm going to reinvent myself. I'm going to get a new friend group. I'm going to, you know, see what Oregon is about socially or wherever you are. Like, there are a lot of goals in addition to your sport goal. What is that coach's goal, especially someone at Oregon track and field? Do they care if you want to, do they care if you want to reinvent yourself? If you're a 17-year-old who's coming cross country, do they care if you might want to study improv? They don't care. The goals that the athlete has and the ones that map onto what the coach has at the NCAA level, not a lot overlapping. And who is in this situation? Who is bending? Who has to renegotiate what this experience is going to be like emotionally and physically and all of those things? The athlete does. Like as a 17-year-old, they're the one renegotiating. Well, I came here and I wanted to run, of course, but I didn't know I was going to get body scanned once a month and that someone was going to monitor my food intake and have me chart it, and I wouldn't have any free time. I'd be running 2-a-days. Like, there is a whole lot that is going on mentally and emotionally with these misaligned goals at the college level versus the pro level. At least the starting point is we have all agreed upon the same set of goals.
And it stopped being fun, and I quit. And I mean, yes, at the professional level, that's a job. We are all clear about why we're here, right? That transition from college to pro, totally different in mindset, 100%. I think it's also fascinating too, when we were talking about this, Amin brought it up about, about how we view the female athletes and the male athletes and how the definitions of being overweight and the definitions of what we're tracking and how we're monitoring it, how different all of those things are. I think too, it never goes away when we talk about language. And I think language is a huge piece of this, is that when we think about how we are addressing these conversations, you can't just put a blanket sports language on it anymore. It is different. When I'm reading that story, it feels different. And it's a really interesting question that, what do we do? We say we're trying to change these paradigms. Like we're trying to create the equality of a sports paradigm. Well, when it comes to weight, the sports language does not land the same way when it comes to men and women. You can't really have the same comment. If you're going to talk about Rodney Rogers and say, oh, he used to call Charles Barkley the round mounder rebound, right? He was the Crisco kid. They used to make fun of all those, all those things. Like, how many times do we look at a male athlete and we just, especially baseball, look at pitchers. I mean, they're completely out of shape all the time. And so the weight conversation, when you talk about how they present, it's a very different set of vocabulary when you're applying that to women. When you watch a tennis match, is it a valuable piece of information to know the height and weight of a woman playing? Absolutely. They never mention weight. So it's interesting as we go into this, as we move into this interesting paradigm, how do you change the paradigm while at the same time, is it equality of language actually something that you would aspire to?
This is definitely one of those situations in the sports world where the way we talk about men, and I know, Howard, this is what you're saying, the way we talk about men, we can't talk about women that way. I mean, we heard, you guys probably didn't follow this, but a very brief story in the WNBA was when the Connecticut Sun coach said something about Liz Cambage.
About Liz Cambage, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And it blew up in a way that that would have just been an offhand comment in the men's sports landscape.
What did he say? He said something like, what am I supposed to do? She weighs 300 pounds. What did he say? Yes. Something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm. So before we get into this, the language and how we seem freer talking about men, I did want to share this as I came across, and it's kind of getting at some of it, which is that the BMI, which is probably a separate conversation, just the origin of the BMI and how we like rank body percentile, but the BMI at which women get teased about their weight is way lower than the BMI at which men get teased. And this this comes from the podcast You're Wrong About. It says women have to be 5 pounds overweight and men have to be about 40 pounds overweight before we start, and this is what studies show, before we start talking about their weight. And then the question comes with like, well, our bodies are societally, culturally, are meant for very different things. Like men's bodies have, you know, culturally, we're like, oh, they're stocky, they'll play football, they're cutting lumber, they're doing all these physical things. Whereas like women's bodies have historically existed to like, you know, inspire lust. I mean, just if that's what we're talking about. And I think there's the difference in language, but then we have to acknowledge that like maybe women feel differently about the way we're talking about their bodies because they have always been viewed as like your body is meant for this purpose. Therefore, it lands much more difficult and it causes more emotional turmoil. Or maybe it doesn't, right? Like I always wonder, do football players feel the same way when they're lined up and getting either weighed or DEXA scans and then they just don't feel like they can actually acknowledge that it's actually painful?
Or back in the old days when they used to put the dunce cap on the players by putting that rubber suit on them and making them run in the corner and make them run laps. Remember?
This has to hurt men, right? I mean,
that's the thing I was going to ask, because it seems like when we talk about the language, it cuts both ways in that on the one hand, women being criticized as overweight, that happens at a much lower delta pressure than it does for men, right?
Yep.
On the other hand, the language with which we are used to talk about men is way harsher than it is.
Especially in
the sports world. So I pulled up the quote from the Connecticut Sun coach, Kurt Miller. And Miller was trying to get a referee to get a foul a foul in the Sun's favor. According to Cambage, Miller remarked to the referee something on the lines, come on, she's 300 pounds. Which, if that happened in the NBA for someone who clearly wasn't that weight,
right,
that's just run-of-the-mill, either shit talk or politicking or whatever, right?
Like, or a compliment.
But there's elements in this story, Amin. There's elements in this story, in this report from the Oregonian, is that Robert Johnson was asking questions about birth control and veering into territories that I don't know, Kate. Like, I was never asked about my reproductive.
Yeah, I think to get, like, we can, the very specific example of Oregon is one thing. Because, I mean, we can get into the details of, like, a lot of these runners, they were dropping so much body fat percentage that they were no longer getting their period, which leads to osteoporosis concerns down the road. So it's like, there's very specific concerns that apply to women about this story. But I do think the general question of, like, how men are actually impacted by this in ways that maybe I don't realize and the general public doesn't realize. Like, men do have eating disorders. Men do come out of, you know, either being publicly shamed, whether it's a presidential physical fitness test, all the way up to like lining up, you know, in your college football and getting weighed. I assume that inspires shame across gender.
Yes. But what I was getting at is this coach, Robert Johnson, felt comfortable enough. Like, he didn't seem to have these barriers of language. He seemed he was comfortable enough to just go directly and ask a very personal question about birth control. And in the article, the athlete had said that was completely out of bounds. I have no idea why he's asking me that question. It should be a question that I talk with my doctor about, not my coach.
Well, he explained that birth control has a tendency to do certain things to a woman's body. And it was within that context that he was asking. Also, I'm not sure of the things that he's wondering if it does to a woman's body. Again, does it have any impact on her as an athlete? I don't know. I think that's the main thing for me. It's not how dare you ask that question. Is the answer actually what you think it is? Is the answer actually doing what you think it does? Because I'm not sure it does.
Yeah, I think to me, one of the pieces of this that is interesting in terms of the navigation is in some of these instances, we're dealing with athletes, we're dealing with athletics, we're dealing with sports. So weight is a relevant question. Weight, right. Especially when you're talking about professionals and you're talking about committing huge guaranteed sums of money. I think we need to at least make a distinction between, okay, is there a hazing language that comes with weight? Absolutely. And that does need a certain discussion. But weight, when you're dealing with human bodies and lots of money and as a business, cannot be ignored either.
I wonder, and as I think Tom, Amin, I'll put you at like the cutting edge of the analytics revolution in the sports landscape, right? The MIT conference circa 2011, right? Whatever that sports analytics revolution is, to me, this is an offshoot of that. At every level, whether we're talking extreme Olympic level, trickling down, Oregon track and field certainly being just below that cut, but funneling kids up, probably all the way down into our club sports and our high school sports. This obsession with the idea that any numerical insight equals competitive advantage and trying to wedge your way in there and exploit it, even if you're not sure, like you said, Amin, that this number that you think you're obsessed with equals this outcome that you desire, and you're making this false correlation because you think if you have this competitive advantage, you will, in a sport where 3 seconds matters, where we're developing sneakers to give you 2% bounce back, like you will have the thing that leads to the Olympic gold medal.
That's exactly right.
To me, this is an offshoot of our obsession with analytics in sports, where we're willing to wedge into places that don't actually have the correlation to success that you think they do.
Obsession without understanding. That's the main thing here. It's like, how can I put this thing as the altar I worship at without ever actually understanding how any of it works? So a great example of this is the NBA pre-draft combine, right? And in it, they measure all this stuff: vertical leap, standing vertical leap, two-step vertical leap, shuttle drill, bench press, all these different things, right? In 2003, a draft that included LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and Carmelo Anthony and Leandro Barbosa and any number of guys that throughout their careers were like, that guy's really athletic. The number one rated athlete was a guy named Luke Jackson. If you don't remember Luke Jackson, it's not your fault. He was a lottery pick for the Cleveland Cavaliers the same year they picked LeBron. And he went to Oregon by a complete coincidence. And Luke Jackson went out there and he I mean, it's not like he didn't fight the numbers. He rated high in all these things. The problem is this: if you ever watch Luke Jackson play, none of us would ever say, whoa, that guy jumps out of the gym. In other words, his athleticism was not functional towards his ability to play basketball, which I would argue is the most important version of athleticism you could possibly have as a basketball player. Rather, his athleticism was within the context of these measurements. How does that happen? Well, when you leave college and you enter the draft and you go into pre-draft training, what you're often doing is you have a skills coach and you have a kind of a athletic trainer. And the skills coach drills you on things that they're going to ask you to do in a pre-draft workout, because surprise, surprise, most NBA teams are very unimaginative in terms of the things they put you to do. And then the athletic trainer drills you on how to ace these tests. So what ends up happening is this guy showed up to the workout and he shot the shit out of it. And then when he went through the drills, oh my God, he jumped, he touched, he shuttled, he benched. But that's not how he actually plays basketball functionally. And all of that comes back down to an obsession with the numbers that you're talking about, Kate.
Well, so he had an SAT tutor?
Yes, it's exactly. It's like doing SAT prep, right? Like knowing, oh, they ask analogies, so this is to that, whatever. And so you got guys that, oh, shot 80% in the drills. Oh, and then in the athletic measurements, he jumped, he shuttled, he did whatever. But none of those actually give us a real understanding what kind of athlete, what kind of player he is. And that's where the false equivalency lies. We said that these numbers are good, but why?
Yeah. Kate, you mentioned MIT Sloan Analytics Conference. One of the like gods of the MIT Sloan Analytics Conference is a man named Haralabhas Vulgaris. And Bob Vulgaris was on Pablo Torre's ESPN Daily podcast a few days ago. One of the most successful NBA bettors of all time joined the Dallas Mavericks as the head of quant analytics guy, and had the ear of Rick Carlisle, the legendary coach of the Dallas Mavericks, who won a championship in 2011. And he, before he took that job, was very much just ideological about numbers, just like, hey, this lineup has a plus 15 net rating, you need to play them more, and no questions asked, that's the lineup you need to put out there. After his couple years with the Dallas Mavericks, someone had asked him, you know, how do you feel about Rick Carlisle or the coaching profession now? Would you still recommend those things and be so just unilateral about your recommendations on which players to play? He's like, absolutely not. Now that I have seen what goes into lineups and the people, the dynamics of the personal relationships of why you play one player or not another player, I would not nearly approach that conversation with the same kind of declarative, you need to play this, that lineup, this player, not that player, because there's so much that goes on into the coaching profession and which player plays and which player doesn't and their relationship and their trust with the coach, that he realized me sitting on my couch and running the numbers and running the spreadsheets is a whole lot easier than actually going up to a player and saying, hey, listen, we're not going to play you tonight. You're going to be a coaching decision. Maybe next game. Like, this experience for him was life-changing. And I think a lot of the questions we have about analytics and whether the numbers actually tell you what they're supposed to be telling you, or should we adhere to, hey, we need to shoot 48% three-pointers versus two-pointers. Look, it's a lot easier said than done. When you go into this locker room and you see Luka Doncic, who is an MVP candidate, or Nikola Jokic, who's an MVP, reigning MVP, a lot of what they look like, or a lot of what their game, where they were drafted in the case of Jokic, that isn't the prototype. And they're so unique as basketball players that you would never be like, hey, Nikola Jokic, you need to work on X, Y, and Z, because you're going to gear the entire program around his skill set. And analytics, or just the quantification of the sport, it's not as cut and dry as like we're just adhering to a formula or a set number, and every team should be striving for that number. The Vavolgaris story, I think, is illustrative of the fact that there's a lot more to sports or professional sports than the spreadsheet, than the mathematician that any good mathematician could be a good track coach. There's so much more to that. And to me, and I'm
that's
sure
that's one of the weirdest things that. A coach would be one who would say that.
To say that about himself.
About his own profession.
His own profession. And it's
baffling.
Like, it seems, I'm inferring, but like baked within that quote, it doesn't allow space for the fact that even mathematicians, I believe, think they are artists. There is an art form to math.
Yes.
And it seems like he's even stripping mathematicians in that quote of the artistry that I think that they believe that they have. He's not even applying to the coaching profession the artistry that the best coaches actually deploy, because no matter how many numbers you have, coaching is at its best an art form. But before, I mean, I don't want any of you to respond to that. I'm just going to like let that sit there.
I mean, I agree. I agree 100%.
So let's circle back around to the Liz Cambage, Kurt Miller interaction, because I think baked into the Oregon story, which is predominantly about these women runners at Oregon and how it has impacted them going forward, is this question about how we talk about not just female athletes, but how we talk about all athletes and male athletes. Because as Kurt Miller is saying flippantly in the middle of a game, you know, well, how could we move her off the post? Like, she weighs 300 pounds.
She's 300 pounds, yeah.
Right. Like, again, more than Liz Cambage weighs. So it's this flippant comment about a woman's weight from a man. And that's just part of this dynamic, why it blew up in the sports world at the moment it did. But that interaction in the NBA would not have even left the moment of its saying, right? I can't imagine. I mean, Tom Howard, you think
non-story.
Right, that it wouldn't have even been anything. No one would have mentioned
it. Would have been a compliment. If you had said, I can't move Shaq, he weighs 1,000 pounds. He'd be like, that's right.
That's right.
You can't move me. You know.
Why did it? Why did it matter? Why doesn't it matter for men?
I this is what I'll say. In my mind, there are things that happen in society, and then there are things that happen within the lines on the court. And are there certain topics that sweep across unequivocally? Absolutely. And then there are things that, man, things get said. And in this case, it's something where a guy is trying to impress upon the referee, hey, she's bigger than my girl or my player. If he had said, oh, come on, I got her weight here, 235 pounds, would Liz Cambage have felt better? It has nothing to do with the number. It has everything to do with what do I have to say to get my player a call? And in this case, whether Liz Cambage took offense or not is kind of irrelevant. The reason it blew up is because we are being more forthcoming about examples of this outside of the arena where men legislate women's bodies, whether it's what's happening in Texas with anti-abortion laws or whether it's the casting agent in a Hollywood movie saying, oh, man, you know, sorry, she's too fat when she's like 110 pounds or whatever, right? That's real life stuff. To me, on a basketball court, there was a part of me that felt for Kurt Miller in the sense I don't feel for him in general, but in this instance, that because of the wave of sentiment about things that actually do matter and do require our swift and unequivocal response to, he got caught up in that in what I felt was like, man, that's basketball. And there's a million other shits that get said, not even to get a call, just to get under people's skin, just to talk shit, that all is kind of part and parcel of this. And the most important part of this was he's not her coach. He's not her general manager. He has no power or control over her. He's the coach of the opposing team.
On his team.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think what it comes down to as well is that the reason is because things aren't equal. You cannot create across the board. Like if you go back to the history of baseball, right? Go back to there are three waves of baseball. There's the immigrant era, there's the integration era, and then there's the money era. You go back to the immigrant era, guys used to crush each other. Go back and read baseball literature. What was Joe DiMaggio's nickname? He was the Dago. They used to call him Dag, the whole thing. The same thing. I mean, that was his nickname, right?
I did not know that one.
integration comes, you're not dropping N-words on each other in the game now, right? It's not the same. The eras change. The language changes, right? And so what do you do with the equality of language in sport when weight is absolutely an important and relevant piece of data? Now that you're dealing with gender, it doesn't land the same way.
I wonder, Kate, is this a story if it's a female head coach of the Oregon track team, or does it even get to that point? Not to paint a broad stroke on all female coaches, but I do think that if the WNBA head coach was a woman in that case, and in the case of Ronald Johnson, like that's part of the story. In the case of Robert Johnson in the UO program, like that is part of this story. This is a man leading these women,
but
right?
I think that it happens to be that it's a man, but I bet that there are dozens of cross country and track coaches, women, who are giving DEXA scans to their athletes right now. I mean, a lot of athletes I know, women who were coached by women who had to get weighed or food shamed, have the same issues that the DEXA scan sparked. I think if, you know, if the head coach of the Connecticut Sun, instead of being Kurt Miller, had been Nancy Lieberman Klein, and she said that, it might not have blown up as big, but it still would have. It still would have been like, you don't say that.
To me, I think that's a major difference between these two stories. In my mind, if Nancy Lieberman is the coach of the Connecticut Sun, this is not a national story. It might be an issue and a conversation and maybe even a fine, but it's not as big a deal. Whereas in the Oregon case, if, I don't know, sadly, the name of a woman track coach, even though I didn't know the name of a male track coach either. But if it were a woman, Tom, this is absolutely still a massive, massive story because it's still about the oppressive conditions that student athletes go through. It's still about, is this stuff, does it even work? What are we doing to these athletes' bodies? The fact that he's a man makes it worse because you add the menstrual cycle stuff, the asking about the birth control stuff. Sure, that adds a level of insensitivity to it that makes it that much worse. But even without that element, if I just removed his name and his gender from this story, it's still a massive story to me.
Yeah. I think what Howard said, just to kind of put a bow on it, about like this pursuit for equality and our idea that like it has to cut both ways the same way, the language you use one direction has to be used the next direction. It is an impossible goal when you add in language that we've always used and then the mixing of gender. And then, I mean, another story we could have down the road be, well, then we're talking about race.
Can you watch a sporting event and have a commentator say she's not fit, right? I mean, we're talking about conditioning, especially in, you know, at this world-class level of conditioning. When Serena Williams came back, those stories were unreal about what, you know, how she came back and what her body looked like after the pregnancy. And everybody was dancing around the fact that she wasn't quite yet ready to play. She wasn't, you know, but could you say it out loud? And that, you know, these are relevant pieces of information if you're going to cover sports, if you're going to talk about sports, and if you're going to watch a tennis match and you can tell that player X is 25 pounds heavier than player X was 3, you know, months ago. How do you talk about that if it's off limits? It can't be off limits, but we actually have to be, you got to be a lot more skillful. You got to find, there's got to be a better way to talk about this because it's going to, I mean, that's TNT. It's going to blow up in your face every single time. And on top of that, when we're talking about that, the BMI differences that you talked about earlier, Kate, you got to confront too, are you really attacking women and trying to use that as some sort of, are you masquerading your misogyny with, I'm just trying to be balanced, man. This is how I would talk about a guy. It's not the same thing.
Tom Haverstraw, Mino Hassan, Howard Bryant, thank you.
Hey, it's Mike, and I know you were hoping for an update on those fishtail ponds in my backyard. Well, have I got news for you. I actually got lighting installed, and I can change it with an app. Beautiful fishtail palms lit up red, depending on my mood. If my hockey team wins, we light those suckers red. Anyways, I like being outside. I like looking at those fishtail palms. You love hearing about it. But what's in my hand other than my app changing the lighting? A Miller Lite is in my hand. That's right, because I know when a Miller Lite is in my hand, I make a good time, Miller time. I take that first sip, I know immediately I made the right call. Nothing goes with my fishtail palms quite like a Miller Lite. It makes everything so much better. And I'm going to have some people over. I'm going to toss them that beautiful white can. They're going to say, heck yeah. And they're going to have that first sip and know, just like me, that they made the right call. Times change, but you can always enjoy the great taste of Miller Lite. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan. Or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.